This episode is brought to you by Chai Pani Restaurant Group.
This week on Meat in 3, we're looking at factors that will shape our food world in 2019. We start with trend predictions and how media covers them.
A website could theoretically devote all their coverage to these viral trends and get all sorts of hits. That's not a way to build sustainable readerships, just as it's not a way to build, sustainable restaurants.
We report on a big change coming and how street meat will be served.
On January 1st, a ban on plastic foam went into effect in New York City.
And we round out the episode with a story about using gene editing to create the spicy tomato of the future.
At first, it sounds like a gimmick or like something that you would do for fun. The truth is, there is a real value behind it.
It's not too late to make your resolution. Subscribe to Meat in 3 wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode this year.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Dr. Monica M. White, Assistant Professor of Environmental Justice, Urban Agriculture, and Community Food Systems at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is the first African-American woman to earn tenure in both the College of Agricultural Life Sciences and the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Her research investigates communities of color and grassroots organizations engaged in the development of sustainable community food systems as a strategy to respond to issues of hunger and food inaccessibility. She has presented widely on these subjects from University of Western Cape in South Africa to UC Berkeley to the Detroit Public Library. She is the author of Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance in the Black Freedom Movement, which was published this month, and it's absolutely excellent. Dr. White.
Hi.
Welcome to A Hungry Society.
Thank you so much for having me. Really delighted about this conversation. Excited.
So when we scheduled this, I need people to know I don't usually do phone interviews.
Ooh.
But for you, I was absolutely, I need Dr. White on the show. So happy we could make this work.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
So Freedom Farmers, how do you tell people about the work that Freedom Farmers, how it came about? How do you explain the book to people?
Sure. So I'm from Detroit, and I had returned to Detroit to take care of my parents, and I needed a research topic. And so I knew about the urban ag movement that was taking place. It's about 2006. But I also knew that all the stories of the folks who were involved in urban agriculture did not represent me or my family. So my father has always grown food in Detroit. My sister grew corn on the east side of Detroit. Mm. And my grandmother even had a container garden. She was in a wheelchair, but she figured if plants could grow outside, they could grow inside. And so all of the folks that I knew grew food, but yet the narratives of the folks who were active in the Detroit Urban Ag Movement didn't represent my community. And so I got involved in the movement, met Baba Malik Yakini, one of the founding organizers of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and really became fascinated by conversations of food sovereignty, food security, agriculture, and the development of sustainable food systems, and wanted to really sort of tell that story. So in order to tell the story of what's happening in Detroit today, we have to figure out from whence we came. And so in addition to what was happening on the ground in Detroit in the urban ag movement, I also wanted to really sort of capture what is it that we know about black farmers. Mm-hmm. And so was really shocked by some of the language describing the relationship between African Americans and agriculture. And it was always from a deficit model. It was always, talking about race in agriculture or black folks and growing food in terms of a negative frame, like sharecropping, tenant farming, slavery. And I knew that there had to be more to that story. especially given the excitement around black folks growing food in Detroit, I knew that there was another story that needed to be told. And so the book you have, the book we're talking about, really is a culmination. It came from involvement in the urban ag movement in Detroit and really was sort of, if we are using food as a strategy to redesign Detroit, have there been other moments in our history, our collective black history, where agriculture has been used as an instrument for freedom, for revitalization, for community wellness, and was really amazed to sort of find so many different historical moments when African Americans did unite with agriculture in an effort to survive, to take care of each other, and to build sustainable communities.
That's so beautiful. I'm curious if in your research and working on this book, there's something that surprised you as you were digging into these histories.
Well, I mean, there were lots of moments of surprise. I mean, you have an idea and you hope that there's some historical context, precedent. Somebody says something that you really, you know, that really captures what you believe. So one of the most beautiful quotes that I use all the time is from Reverend Wendell Paris. He's one of the early organizers for the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, which just celebrated its 51st year. He said, "You can free yourself when you can feed yourself." So for me, the power in that statement, I wanted to find the scholarship that would help elevate his belief and his actions, along with those in Detroit and other folks who were turning to agriculture as a way to care for themselves, as a way to organize when the economic bottom has fallen out. And so I think for me, the surprise was hearing and seeing the evidence that was in support of the argument that I wanted to make. I think another surprise for me was, you know, being raised in Detroit and, you know, pretty active in terms of black history. I had a particular perspective of orientation of Booker T. Washington. And so as difficult as it was, I tried to erase what I thought I knew and was really surprised in thinking about how much Washington really did for future generations of farmers. So it wasn't just in the form of Tuskegee that still exists, but it was in the various ways that he really created infrastructure for black farmers. I think if there's any other sort of surprises, I think understanding and realizing the importance of George Washington Carver and his contributions to sustainable agriculture, which we fail to recognize him as what I think the father of sustainable agriculture, really, and also his contributions in crossing the divides, right? So for George Washington Carver, it wasn't just, can you, you know, come to my classes, but in the movable school, I will make sure that whatever information I collect, whatever data, whatever studies I do, I make that information accessible and available, not just to those who come to my classes, but those who work in the field. So I feel like those, maybe not surprises, but they were really welcomed experiences in writing the book.
Yeah, it really comes across. And so, you know, I was getting ready for this interview, I came across this Q&A that you did with Cynthia Greenlee for Civil Eats. And it's beautiful. But there's this part that I want to read in particular about, you know, the process of writing Freedom Farmers. And you say that, this is a quote, "One thing that I have fallen so in love with is the farmer's freedom. There's a certain kind of freedom that people who produce food have. They have a sense of agency. And I don't think it's ever discussed when we talk about who farmers are." So I thought that was so beautiful in relation the scope of the work and talking about how the black community, you know, the relationship to farming and freedom. And I think that's just so, it's very beautiful.
Thank you. And I don't think, I mean, I think that we tend to think we know who farmers are or who producers are, but I don't know that we really do. I think we respond whether there's food, whether there's sufficient food, what kind of food, what do you feel like, but I don't think we really honor the labor and those who labor to make sure that we have access to nutrient-rich food. And so hanging out with farmers, just I really was able to establish such a respect for folks who go out in all temperatures. We're now in the middle of a polar vortex, and there are farmers that are going out to care for their crops and to care for their, you know, their herds. And so I just feel like there's such a lack of, often overlooked, we overlook the contributions and the labor of those who provide for us. And I really do want to make sure that, that part gets across.
So another big part of the book is you talk about collective agency.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to the Black community's relationship to agriculture. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that term?
Sure. So agency is the decision to bring about a change, either for me socially, politically, or economically. And often studied as a psychological construct, right? So what is it that makes you join a movement or vote a particular way or do certain kinds of things? So for me, agency is both psychological, but it's also sociological in that we understand and can explain or understand the ways that African Americans, particularly in a city like Detroit, who have organized, mobilized, and decided to take blighted blocks or lots and turn them into food producers. But more than just growing food, it's building relationships. Oftentimes, like at D-Town Farm, we have, you can do blood pressure screening or take classes on vegan cooking or, you know, incorporating some of the foods that we grow into your daily or weekly, you know, food selection. So to me, this relationship, this understanding of I can bring about a change, join with others who believe we can bring about a change, needs a collective or a component that captures the actions that a group of people do to transform their community's access to healthy food. And I think that that comes through in a contemporary sense in many of the urban ag projects that we see in cities like Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, New Orleans. You see a lot of folks really engaging in agriculture and connecting themselves to growing their own nutrient-rich food.
And there's a historical precedent for that too.
Right,
in some of the
right.
stories that you tell and talk about, like, can you give an example? I don't want to give it since we have the author.
Thank you. Well, you know, one of the things that I really think about is the relationship between labor. Okay, cancel that part. But one of the examples I can offer is with Mrs. Hamer, Fannie Lou Hamer, that we recognize as having, you know, spoken up for the right to vote, then returned to Mississippi and created Freedom Farm. And if you think about it, when folks registered, when African Americans went to register to vote, some of whom were fired because they voted, but then they were also evicted as a part of their condition of their employment with the landowner. And so you had folks who exercised their right to vote but were homeless and unemployed. And Mrs. Hamer said, okay, well, come here to Freedom Farm. Here we have 680 acres. They had a mobile medical unit. They had Head Start. They had commercial kitchens. They had classes where they were teaching food preservation. They had all the things that we think are really new right now. Mrs. Hamer was like, okay, so look, here's what we do. And to me, the beauty of that is that I just imagine myself, if I was somebody who believed that I have the right to vote and then did vote and then was punished in that particular way, what must it have felt like to feel that all of your everything was contingent upon someone who benefited from your oppression in many ways. The opposite of that, Mrs. Hamer saying, we can work together, we can do things together, we can look out for each other. In this cooperative, what power must that have felt like for folks who had recently been fired and evicted? And so I think that, to me, is an example of collective agency. We come together and make a decision that things are going to be different. And what does that look like when we pull our resources together? We know how to grow. So now, once we know how to grow, then what else can we do? And I think that that's both historical and it's occurring today in cities that we mentioned.
Yeah. I think in your book, it really, you really feel the complete power of food, of growing food, of agriculture. And I think we don't see it that way oftentimes, but it's completely true. Like, to have that agency, to be able to come together in communities, it's a way of building power.
And it's also, I think, it also offers us a way to look. When I mentioned earlier about the deficit model of thinking about Black folks and food production, slavery, tenant farming, and sharecropping, sometimes, you know, as Chimamanda Adichie mentioned, sometimes we get stuck on a single story, right? It's
right.
way too easy to talk about the oppressive relationship between black folks and agriculture. But what are some of the liberatory aspects and components of black folks and agriculture? And that was really what, that to me is really the story that I wanted to elevate.
Right. It's I've been thinking about that too with the work that Michael Twitty does, food
yeah.
historian. And
yeah.
There are some people in the black community that have a very visceral reaction to seeing a black man in clothing from that time period and,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Acting out the cooking processes
yeah.
of that time period. And
sure.
I think it's because of what you are talking about, where it's this
right.
sort of seeing it as this oppressive force and not wanting to touch that, and people see agriculture that way too.
Right. Yes, and folks like Michael Twitty, but also Julius Tillery, who works with black cotton. You know, his family owns land, and is really trying to embrace our agricultural roots and to change the narrative. And thinking just about the name, Julius, maybe somebody that you would be interested in talking to. So I think the beauty of Julius Tillery's work is around taking the legacy of growing cotton and embracing it as a part of our heritage. For example, I was thinking and talking to Mr. Ben Burkett, who is a third-generation farmer in Petal, Mississippi, and I would often ask him questions. I would spend days in the archives, and then at night we would get together, we'd have dinner, and I'd be able to ask him some questions. And so I was thinking about this crop of cotton, and I was like, well, Mr. B, tell me about this cotton. He was like, you know, folks can talk about the damage and the pain of cotton as a part of our legacy. But he said cotton sent me to college, you know. And so to think about that, there are ways we can think about things in an oppressive sense, but also in a liberatory sense. I think it gets us to think in a more nuanced way, opposed to just binaries. This is, or just, you know, not even binaries, just extremes. This is good versus this is bad. But
right.
it can be good and bad. And I think that it's important for us to use a lens that embraces our food production, our connection to the land, connection to the environment, and to think, as we have a moment, to think about how do we redesign cities around food production in ways where we make sure that everyone has access to nutrient-rich foods in ways that actually help regenerate a community, opposed to resource extraction.
Right. Oh my goodness, I'm in here nodding. I'm nodding so hard. But those binaries, you've actually talked about that before, where you were saying, you know, we shouldn't be like E.B. Du Bois
right.
is right, or
right.
Booker T. Washington is right. Solutions
right.
are going to take, you know, pulling
That's
from
right.
from
That's
everybody.
Right. And one of the things, I mean, you know, one of the things that I had to do in writing the book, I had to really almost erase what I thought I knew about these great people and to look at their literature with fresh eyes, look at what they said with a new analysis. And what I felt in my soul was that Booker T. and Du Bois really did have a language or a conversation, even though we got stuck on the friction, right? They really had something that they could offer us. And if it didn't happen 100 years ago, maybe now is the time for us to revisit those discussions.
Right, right. So you've mentioned Julius Tillery.
Yes.
Who else should listeners be keeping an eye out for and following in that space?
Well, sure. Leah Penniman, Soulfire Farm, Dara Cooper, the National Black Food and Justice Alliance. There are several organizations, the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. We also have SAFON, the Southeast African American Organic Farmers Network. There are lots of organizations that are geared toward providing resources for returning farmers or African Americans that are interested in returning to air property, moving back to the South in a reverse migration, but in interested in doing more work, particularly with production is you know, the folks that I'm thinking of. But also there are lots of food justice organizations and activities that are doing really good work.
Excellent. And what I always like to ask authors this, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
What I hope, I would like to challenge what we think we know about the relationship between African Americans, not just farming, but African Americans and the environment. Often, if it doesn't happen in this particular way, at this particular time, it's as if it never happened. And I think that to look at the ways in which African Americans have grown food, or African Americans have done fishing, or, you know, any of the outdoor activities, look at how, when, and why we've done it requires a new lens, opposed to just assuming that we don't do it. I really want to push back against the negative narratives of the outdoors, and specifically food production, and to really sort of say, okay, so what are some other ways that food lends itself to a freedom agenda or a freedom strategy? But not just food, right? I mean, I'm hoping that in social movements, we often think about boycotts, protests, and marches. What I hope a reader comes from reading the book thinking, okay, well, there were folks who were thinking about food production as a strategy toward freedom, and that narrative has been ignored. And so if it's not a boycott, if it's not a march, if it's not a protest, it's actually building inward. And isn't that something that we could think about? What are some other ways that people resist and show their dissatisfaction with a particular way, but also doing so in a way that builds a community wellness?
Right, right. Wow. No, that's wonderful. I feel like this is a great foundational piece of work that I hope for decades and decades people reference.
Oh, wow.
And, you know,
that's so sweet.
On.
Thank you.
It's incredible, and I'm very happy for you.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Corsa. That's so sweet. Wow.
You're welcome. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Monica White.
This episode is brought to you by Chai Pani Restaurant Group. From Bombay to Buncombe and Asheville to Atlanta, Chai Pani has extended the love of food, culinary experience, and storytelling to the Southeast. Founded by Meherwani and Molly Irani, Chai Pani Restaurant Group includes two locations of Chai Pani, plus MG Road Bar and Lounge, Botiwala, Buxton Hall Barbecue, and their new spice company, Spicewala. Learn more about Chai Pani and watch their documentary series, Cutting Chai, at chaipanirestaurantgroup.com. That's Chaipani restaurantgroup.com.
All right, so we are back with Dr. Monica White, author of Freedom Farmers. So now in the second half of Hungry Society, we always like to talk about dining. Do you have any specific dining memories growing up?
Yes, I do. My dad, Dr. Maurice White, who was an educator, he was an educational psychologist, food was his love language. So cooking for you, growing food for you, that was his way to show how much he loved. And lots of people in Detroit knew him for his feijoada. Mm. His black beans were amazing. And his cooking skills, that would be, I think, my most vivid early memories. And then when it was your birthday, everybody came to one place and you got to dictate the menu. So it was, you know, food was always something very celebrated in our house. It was always a way that we express love, that we enjoy each other. And I think most vividly of my dad, who was the most clear example of food as a love language.
Feijoada sounds so good right now. It's cold outside. Yeah. I definitely want a big plate of feijoada. So for listeners who don't know what feijoada is, it's the national dish of Brazil. Mm-hmm. And it's black beans and different pork pieces cooked in the black beans. Mm-hmm. And I think greens on the side, right?
Yep. And then a nice piece of cornbread. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And funny, my grandmother, who was born in Mississippi, she at home would eat her greens with her hands.
Oh, wow.
And it was really important for her, you know, in public, right? But at home, you know, it was a combination of the greens and the cornbread. And I remember you know, as a child, you were like, okay, grandma likes her greens with greens and cornbread with her hands. But then there was, I had read something where nutritionists said eating with your hands is actually a good way to begin the digestive process.
Oh, wow.
So my grandma was a genius and we didn't know.
Yeah. Did you have any restaurants in particular that your family went to a lot?
You know, we didn't do a lot of restaurants growing up. Mm-hmm. My dad was a cook, and he cooked all the time. And only later in life would we go, like, to restaurants after church. But for the most part, we really didn't do a whole lot of restaurants. I will say that being in Detroit, we were introduced early to Middle Eastern cuisine. And so as a child, you know, eating hummus and baba ganoush and, you know, tabbouleh, a lot of the dishes that are common now were really kind of commonplace for us. So, yeah.
Do you go out a bit now?
I do on occasion. Yes, I do. Yes, yes.
Do you have any favorite restaurants that you go to over and over again?
I do like Pan Asian. Mm-hmm. I do like Korean. Thinking about a nice bowl of pho right now. Yes, so I'm definitely into more of the Asian cuisines at the moment, yes.
Mm. So, you know, I always ask every guest this. Okay, without naming names, or you can name the restaurant if you want to, what's one of the worst dining experiences you've ever had?
You know, Corsia, that really, I'm stuck on that. I am an easy eater, so I usually enjoy what I order. I can't think easily about a bad dining experience. I think the only thing I can come up with is if I go to a restaurant and order something that isn't their strength.
Mm.
So I try to stick with their, you know, either their specials or, you know, something that I know they do really well. But for the most part, I couldn't think of a worse dining experience. I can't really think of one.
Mm. Mm. I'm curious what you make of the restaurant scene where you're at around Madison. Like, what is the food scene like there?
So there are lots of different kinds of restaurants, different ethnic restaurants that are here. They're very American cuisine, as in bratwurst, burgers, lots of fries, cheese curds. I had never heard of. I mean, I'd heard of it, but, you know, you want your curd to squeak mm-hmm. because that means it's fresh. And everything that can possibly be paired with beer. So, yes, lots of brats. Lots of different kinds of,
Cheese curds also sound good right now, but they always sound good, though.
Right, they do. They do. They are good. They are good.
I can't believe we're already at the last question.
Oh, are we?
I know. Yeah, this went by really fast. If you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who's invited?
So I can have a last meal. I think, so there's an interesting part of the book. It was after I had submitted the edited volume. When I was finishing up the book and had submitted my revisions, my mother was having some health challenges, and I called my aunt to ask her, you know, some questions. And at the end of the phone call, I remembered my grandfather had a store in the front of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in Eden, North Carolina, and I would go down south. My granddad was a farmer, so he had, you know, a couple acres in the back. But there was a store attached to the front of the house. So I asked my aunt, I said, well, can you tell me about the store? And she said, yes, it was called the Community Store. So I said, oh, my goodness, Aunt Barbara, tell me more. So she said, yes, your grandfather with eight other farmers bought a car. They shared the car, and the Community Store was a cooperative where black folks in the community could buy with respect.
Mm.
So the funny part is I ended up writing a story about my own family without even knowing it.
Mm.
So if I could have a meal, it would be in North Carolina. It would be with my grandparents, and I'm sure some collards and some cornbread would be served with a nice macaroni and cheese. My sister makes macaroni and cheese with a cheesy spot that she lets you know what a cheesy spot is with the extra paprika.
Okay.
So that would, I think that would be, if I could have a last meal, it would be with my grandparents in Eden, North Carolina.
Mm. So it would just be the four of you around the table?
Ooh, if I could do it with other folks, it might be even with Mrs. Hamer, mm-hmm. George Washington Carver, mm-hmm. maybe even Du Bois in there, maybe have Washington come back and see if they would mend their fences.
And what are you drinking with your meal?
Oh, you have to have iced tea, either iced tea or red Kool-Aid.
All right. Yes.
That's the flavor.
Are you making the Kool-Aid or is somebody else making the Kool-Aid?
No, I'll make it.
Yeah, I'll make it. Okay.
Yeah.
Are you the designated?
Are you coming? Will you join us?
I will stop by. Yes. This sounds really good.
Yay. I would love to.
That'll be fun. I always like to add, you know, if someone grew up with Kool-Aid in their childhood, who got to make it? Because everybody couldn't make the Kool-Aid.
That's true.
Some people added too much sugar, some people added Kool-Aid. Enough.
We didn't do a lot of beverages. I don't remember a lot of beverages outside of water and tea.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. We definitely had tea, too. So I grew up in the summers. I would go visit my grandmother in Virginia Beach.
Mm.
And, you know, nice. She did, like, Southern cooking. Like, she would cook in Crisco and Kool-Aid and fried chicken, and the food was so good. Still some of the best fried chicken I've ever had in my life.
Wow.
But yeah, the Kool-Aid was like, you know, it was me and my cousins. Who makes it the best? I made it a couple times. They were like, nope.
Uh-oh. Never again. Honey.
Never again.
Don't let Corsa get the Kool-Aid.
Yep. So my cousin Ashanti made the Kool-Aid, and it was pretty good.
All right.
Well, Dr. White, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Corsa. Really enjoyed having a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, and you are welcome back on anytime.
Thank you.
And I feel like I could just listen to you talk about Freedom Farmers for hours and hours.
Oh, how sweet of you. Thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week on A Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.